Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Controversy erupted earlier this year with the publication of the book Forget the Alamo. The authors argue that the narrative of the 1836 battle at the Alamo wasn't centered on independence, but on the preservation of slavery. To suggest that Davy Crockett, Jim Bowie, and William Travis weren't martyrs to the cause of freedom was sacrilegious in many circles. But the connection between slavery and Texas independence wasn't unknown to historians. Nearly all of the Alamo defenders were slave owners. Many of the Anglos who came to Texas prior to 1836 brought their slaves in hopes they could take advantage of the agricultural opportunities the vast landscape offered. The only problem? Slavery wasn't allowed in Texas. Mexico wouldn't allow it. And it isn't just today's historians who made the connection between slavery and the Texas Revolution. Abolitionists and some northern politicians in the U.S. at the time saw the Texas fight for independence as a war to preserve slavery. Historian Alice Baumgartner examines the U.S. and Mexico's complicated ties to slavery in her book South to Freedom, Runaway Slaves to Mexico and the Road to the Civil War. Baumgartner says Mexico's stance on slavery didn't just spur Texas independence, it had a major influence on politics to the North.
One of the big debates, as I think all Texans know, about the Alamo had to do with why would you defend the Alamo? Why not, as Sam Houston wanted, return and concentrate your troops in eastern Texas? And the defenders of the Alamo wanted to defend it in part because of the belief that if they could stop Santa Anna's army from getting close to those plantations in eastern Texas, that they would avoid the Mexican government promising freedom to enslaved people and thus cause a slave revolt in Texas, that there was this desire to keep this Mexican army away from those plantation centers with large populations of enslaved people. So abolitionists and Texas revolutionaries alike recognized that slavery was part of this conflict. And that became a liability for the Republic of Texas after winning its independence, because the revolution itself racked up a huge amount of debt. And one of the solutions to the financial problems that the Republic of Texas was experiencing almost from the beginning was to annex itself to the United States. The problem was that these abolitionists in the North were saying, we can't condone this revolution that was in favor of slavery. And people in England were saying the same thing, that all of the English, they were wary of recognizing the independence of Texas because England fashioned itself as an anti-slavery nation. And they didn't feel comfortable recognizing a revolution that they too were saying was a revolution in favor of slavery. And so that became a liability. We see a surge of rhetoric coming from the Republic of Texas that is really refashioning the revolution as one in favor of liberty.
So ultimately, the U.S. did get Texas. Texas was admitted as a slave state, but that really wasn't enough for the U.S. The U.S. had long been itching to invade Mexico. And this is what sort of leads up to that U.S.-Mexico war. There was that whole dispute about where does the border really lie between the U.S. and Mexico. At first, it was the Nueces River, but the U.S. wanted it extended out to the Rio Grande. And ultimately, in order to avoid sort of this impending invasion from the U.S., Mexico was actually trying to appease the U.S. a bit. In people would come in to look for slaves. Mexico would at times say, okay, here's some slaves, please don't invade us. If anybody knows anything about the history of Mexico, there have been a lot of wars, a lot of battles, a lot of assassinations, a lot of political turmoil in Mexico, and all that up to this point had really drained Mexico economically and military-wise. So it really was not prepared for any kind of invasion from the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. That Mexico abolished slavery a year after the end of the Texas Revolution, and that decision helped to bolster this vision of the Texas Revolution in England and the northern United States as a conflict over slavery. But the fact that Mexico had abolished slavery didn't necessarily mean that they were going to protect fugitive slaves. That there's a difference between abolition, which is a domestic policy. It says that enslaved people within the boundaries of this nation will be free, and what is known at the time as the freedom principle, the idea that all enslaved people who set foot on the soil of whatever nation passes this law, that they will be free. And so in the years after the Texas Revolution, when Mexico is trying not to give the United States any excuse to annex Texas, because they are still hoping to be able to return it to the Mexican fold, in much the same way that the Lincoln administration didn't want any foreign powers to recognize the independence of the Confederacy because he wanted to restore the Union. And if Mexico protected fugitive slaves, there were ample precedents for that being an excuse for an invasion. And so Mexico was trying to walk this very difficult line of not antagonizing the United States, while at the same time trying to do anything it could to return Texas to Mexico. And one of those strategies was abolishing slavery, trying to circulate to the enslaved people in Texas. They were free under Mexican law. Mexico still claimed Texas as part of the nation. And they had hoped that anti-slavery would be this weapon for, as you mentioned, a weak country, that they saw enslaved people as allies in this fight to try to destabilize the Republic of Texas enough that it would be forced to surrender its independence.
Can you explain a little bit about how your book does lead to the Civil War? How all these events we've been talking about, how does that all tie in to the Civil War? How is Mexico involved in this?
It's a great question. I'm going to give you a very brief tour through U.S. history and the question of slavery and expansion. During the American Revolution, we know there are 13 colonies. At the end of the Revolution, they have territories that extend further west. And the question immediately becomes, what will be the status of slavery? The solution that Congress arrives at is to respect slavery where it exists. And that leads to a rough division of the Western territories between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. And Congress prohibits slavery in northern regions where they don't think that there's any enslaved people. There were, but where they don't think that there's enslaved people, they say no slavery. And where there are enslaved people, they allow slavery to continue. And the problem becomes when the United States conquers Mexican territory where slavery had been explicitly abolished, that no longer was the United States Congress able to just say, well, we can sort of divide it up amongst ourselves based on our understandings of where we think slavery will extend and where it currently exists, because they had incorporated territory for the first time where slavery had been explicitly abolished. And congressmen believed that if they reestablished slavery in those territories, they would not only be committing a moral wrong, that's what some congressmen thought, but other congressmen, perhaps the majority of congressmen, feared that that was a violation of the Constitution. The Constitution, according to strict constructionists at the time, didn't allow Congress to interfere with slavery at all. And the threat of all of that territory joining the Union as free territories, and that was terrifying, not only because it would mean that Southern senators would be outnumbered by non-slaveholding senators in Congress. It also meant that fugitives from slavery would be able to maybe find refuge in these free territories, and that posed a threat to slavery. And so the pro-slavery politicians in Congress desperately wanted to restore the balance of power between the slaveholding and non-slaveholding states in any way that they could. And they did that in a variety of ways. They tried to build a southern transcontinental railroad that would connect the South and the Southwest. So even if the Southwest didn't become a plantation empire, that the interests, their interests would be aligned with the South. That's what contributed to the Gadsden Purchase of 1853, which got us the southern territories of Arizona and New Mexico. They tried to annex Cuba in 1854. And perhaps most notably, they tried to, and succeeded at overturning the Missouri Compromise line, which had prohibited slavery north of 3630 in the Louisiana Territory. That opened up the Nebraska and Kansas territories to slavery, or the possibility of slavery, which led to violence in Kansas over whether or not that territory would become a free state. So all of these points on the usual timeline of how we get to the Civil War are actually responses, solutions to the problem that was caused by the conquest of free territories from Mexico.
Dr. Alice Baumgartner is an assistant professor of history at the University of Southern California and is the author of South to Freedom: Runaway Slaves to Mexico and the Road to the Civil War. When we come back, Baumgartner doesn't just focus on the dates and battles and laws that we memorize in schools in her book. It tells the stories of some of the enslaved persons those battles and laws directly affected.
So their stories seemed like a really important corrective for understanding the history of Texas and also the history of the United States more broadly.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The story of slavery in the U.S. often centers on the policymakers who created the laws, or even on the slave owners who were often the policymakers. There's the story of Southerner John Kirkham, who in 1820, when traveling to Mexican Texas to find four escaped slaves, encountered Moses Austin, father of Stephen F., who was looking for land for a group of settlers. Lots is known about Stephen Austin's continuation of his father's mission, but nothing was really known about the enslaved people Kirkham was trying to recover. Their names were Richard, Martin, Phoebe, and Samuel. They escaped to Mexico, where they successfully petitioned for their freedom. There's also the story of Joe, who was enslaved by Alamo defender William Travis. Joe's story is a little more widely known. The Mexican army chose to spare his life at the Battle of the Alamo because he was a slave. What isn't well known is that on the one-year anniversary of the Battle of San Jacinto, he drove a carriage to a ball commemorating the victory. Once his charge had exited the carriage and entered the festivities, Joe and a Mexican servant named Domingo released the horses from the carriage, mounted them, and rode southwest to Mexico. The stories of the enslaved, whose legacy was hidden from history, are brought to light in historian Alice Baumgartner's book, South to Freedom: Runaway Slaves to Mexico and the Road to the Civil War. Baumgartner says she was compelled to write about their resourcefulness and ingenuity.
The stories of the freedom seekers themselves were one of the things that really drew my attention in this project, because their resourcefulness, their ingenuity, their ability to navigate these complex and changing legal systems was so astonishing to me, and really felt like it was a part of the history that had been overlooked. We know about Moses Austin and Stephen Austin. We don't know about James Kirkham and these enslaved people who escaped from his plantation and secured their freedom in Mexico. And that forgetting, the erasure of those stories, makes it a lot easier to think of the founding of Texas as an event that had nothing to do with slavery. So their stories seemed like a really important corrective for understanding the history of Texas and also the history of the United States more broadly. It's also important to understanding the rise of anti-slavery in Mexico, that long before Mexico had abolished slavery in 1837, long before Mexico had passed a constitution in 1857 that promised freedom to all enslaved people who set foot on its soil, enslaved people were escaping to New Spain and then Mexico and claiming their freedom under these very specific laws, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. But their actions were part of the reason that the Mexican government started to see enslaved people as potential allies in this fight, first against Texas and then against the United States. And so their actions are crucial to this larger political story of what's happening in Mexico City and in Washington, D.C.
One of the other, it was a kind of a very brief narrative, but I thought it was is very important. You mentioned a slave, Jean-Antoine. In 1835, he escaped on a brig to Mexico. They found him. They sent him back to New Orleans. And when he arrived, he stabbed himself to death because he could not see himself living a life again as a slave in America.
Yeah, that story, I still remember. I get goosebumps every time I think of him and just remember I found the documents about what had happened to him in the records from the Mexican consul in New Orleans. Those are housed at the Archive of Foreign Relations in Mexico City. It's this basement archive. And I just remember sitting there reading what had happened to him and just being so moved and blown away by this man who had, as you said, hid himself in the hold of a brig bound for Campeche, Mexico. He was there inside hiding for 11 days and was so close to making it to freedom, or to, not to freedom, but to Mexico, when he was caught and returned on the next ship bound back to New Orleans. And this happened in 1835. So it's 2 years before Mexico abolished slavery. So he didn't have a really strong legal claim to freedom in Mexico at that time. But the ship that he, this is, it's one of those things where you think, if you read it in a novel, it would feel unbelievable. The ship that he's returned on is captained by a Mexican citizen who the previous year had been accused in New Orleans of having helped another enslaved person escape to freedom in Mexico. But this time, this captain returns Jean-Antoine. And as you mentioned, he somehow, maybe he found this dagger himself, and maybe the ship captain gave it to him, but he kills himself. And it really drives home to me the very human consequences of these political decisions that are made far away. And it also drives home just how horrible slavery must have been, that someone would prefer death and death by that in that way to going back to bondage.
Alice, your book is so detailed. I'm curious as to how much of your life it took over when you were writing this book. It must have been just sort of this all-encompassing experience that it must have been sort of hard to get yourself out of once you were done.
It was so hard. I actually have a friend and colleague, Amy Greenberg, who's a wonderful U.S. historian. And she told me that whenever she's writing a book, she gets book brain, where she's unable to focus on anything else. And that's exactly how I felt, that there was this period of, I worked on this book for 8 years, And particularly when I was writing and revising in the last couple of years, that I couldn't, it was almost monomaniacal. It was so hard for me to think about anything else. I was so deep in the story. And you know, I'm obviously biased, and I think probably everyone who puts in the time to write a book feels this way. But I really felt like the story, that it was an enormous honor and responsibility to have found these documents and to tell these stories. And I felt like that had to be the priority over everything else in my life, to try to do justice to stories like Jean Antoine's.
Dr. Alice Baumgartner is an assistant professor of history at the University of Southern California and is author of South to Freedom, Runaway Slaves to Mexico, and The Road to the Civil War. Hear part one of my interview with Baumgartner at tpr.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show online at tpr.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.